This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
That working? All right. Good morning, everyone. My name's Chad McCall. I'm an associate priest here. I think I know everybody in the room, but welcome to Crail C. We're excited to welcome Brent Landau this morning. He is a professor at UT and teaches in the religion department there. He has his PhD and MDiv from Harvard, correct? And his undergrad, he's an Iowa Hawkeye, so in his undergrad. So they won yesterday. My dad's a Hawkeye, so I follow them. Right. So I'll let you introduce your talk and we'll get going. And if you do come up to the mic, or if you do have a question, we ask that you come to the mic, because we do most likely we'll have some folks on Zoom, and that way they can hear the question.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chad. Great to see everyone here this morning. This is, I guess, the first time that I've lectured in Crail C in a couple of years. You know, obviously there's been some stuff going on, but it's great to be back with you folks. My topic today is, as you see the title here, which is probably a little bit different than how it was, kind of advertised, but it's still the same basic idea. The Christmas stories, how historical are the Gospels' accounts of Jesus's birth? And notice there, you've got a plural, stories, not the Christmas story. Okay. And I'll explain that. Well, we call it the Christmas story, the story of Jesus's birth. However, the Christmas story as we know it is not actually found in any one gospel. It is instead a blending of the infancy narratives from the gospels of Matthew and Luke, and only Matthew and Luke, because there is no birth narrative in the Gospel of Mark. And there is no birth narrative in the Gospel of John. So it's blending of the infancy narratives from Matthew and Luke and supplemented by traditions and details found outside the New Testament. I'm going to start this presentation by recapping the different Christmas stories of Matthew and Luke. And then I will discuss what biblical scholars believe about their overall historical accuracy. And this may be, for some folks, a rather shocking or at least surprising approach to these cherished biblical stories. But I do hope that we can have a thoughtful dialogue about how much the historicity of these stories matters. Okay. So we're going to start with the Gospel of Matthew, because the Gospel of Matthew is not only thought by scholars to perhaps be written a little bit earlier than the Gospel of Luke, but it's also decidedly less complex infancy narrative. It's a good bit shorter. Okay, so what is found in Matthew's infancy narrative? Well, it starts chapter 1, verses 1 through 17. With a genealogy of Jesus. Genealogies are a feature of Israelite literature. If anybody has tried to, kind of read through the Bible from start to finish, most people are doing pretty well, and then they hit Genesis 5, and you have a whole genealogy chapter, and if you get past that, then there's Genesis 10, which is another one, and that tends to weed out most people. But some notable features of this genealogy. First off, Luke also has a genealogy. Matthew's genealogy traces Jesus's descent back to Abraham, the traditional founder of the Jews, the individual from Genesis with whom God enters into a covenant for the first time. So that's one notable feature. It indicates the sort of Jewish perspective, thoroughly Jewish perspective, of the author of the Gospel of Matthew. Luke, on the other hand, who is not Jewish by birth, most likely, he has a genealogy, and his genealogy goes back to Adam, the first human being. So right then and there, you can see some differences. And if you were to actually, you know, kind of put the genealogies side by side and compare them, you would not only notice, you know, a difference in length, but you would also notice a difference in some of the names. So you can find that as close to sort of Jesus as the question of who Jesus's grandfather is supposed to be. Okay, and then apart from this descent back to Abraham, there is also the presence of women, or at least a few women in the genealogy, which is interesting in and of itself because genealogies tend to be a male-centered affair. But in addition to Mary, Matthew also mentions four women from the Hebrew Bible: Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba, all of whom conceived children under irregular circumstances. So that might be sort of paving the way for what happens next, which is Matthew 1, 18 through 25. So Joseph discovers that Mary, to whom he is engaged, is pregnant. And since the penalty for consensual sex outside of marriage was death, Joseph intends to divorce her quietly. An angel appears to Joseph. There is no annunciation to Mary in the Gospel of Matthew. An angel appears to Joseph, who tells him that Mary has conceived by the Holy Spirit. Matthew tells us that this fulfills Isaiah 7:14. Behold, a virgin will conceive and bear a son. If you actually look at the original Hebrew of Isaiah 7:14, it actually says, behold, a young woman will conceive. So it is, you know, somewhat questionable whether there was, whether Isaiah's original wording of this verse was intended to be some sort of prophecy of something miraculous taking place. Then we go to chapter 2 of Matthew's infancy narrative. So magi from the east appear in Jerusalem, asking King Herod where the king of the Jews has been born. We call these individuals the wise men, but this is not the wisest move on their part. You know, Herod has this reputation as a bloodthirsty, murderous king, and these guys just sort of bumble in there and are like, okay, where's the new king of the Jews who's been born? Not you, the new one. Okay, yeah. And all Jerusalem is kind of nervous about this. So they say that they've seen a star that somehow signifies the birth of a new king of the Jews. Herod summons the Jewish priests and teachers who report to him that the Messiah is to be born in Bethlehem. Herod asks the Magi when the star appeared and tells them to bring word to him of the child's whereabouts. Then the star leads the Magi directly to Bethlehem and stands over the house, notice it's a house, not a stable, where the child is. They offer him gifts, and being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they go back to their homeland, wherever that is, by another route. If you know anything about my research, you might be aware how difficult it is for me to only talk about the Magi on one slide, since I sort of wrote the book on them, or at least a book. So this came out in, it's been a while now, it's been 12 years. This came out in 2010, and it was basically my translation of a ancient Christian legend about the wise men, and it was picked up by HarperCollins, which was nice, and you know, kind of led to a decent amount of publicity. It's technically out of print now. Kindle, you know, you can certainly get an ebook version. You can find, you know, a print copy, you know, at in used bookstores. So it's a neat story. Okay, and then going on in chapter 2, Herod learns that the Magi have deceived him And he gives orders to kill all boys two and under based on when the Magi said that the star appeared. So putting this together, it sort of sounds like the star appeared at the time that Jesus was born. So this is said by Matthew to fulfill Jeremiah 31:15 about Rachel weeping for her children. And then an angel tells Joseph to flee out of Egypt with Mary, to flee to Egypt with Mary and Jesus. And this is said to fulfill Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I have called my son. So what you're starting to see here is that Matthew in particular seems to be really concerned about events in the life of Jesus fulfilling passages from the Hebrew scriptures. And this is just something that you see again and again. And it's something that is unique to Matthew. You don't see this emphasis on the fulfillment of scripture, certainly not in the explicit way that Matthew does. You don't see it in other gospels. Then when Herod dies, an angel tells Joseph to return to Israel. He intends to return to Bethlehem, but he's afraid to do so because Herod's son is now in charge. So an angel tells him to settle in Nazareth in Galilee instead. And just so you're sort of clear on the distances and the sort of overall geography here, Bethlehem is just outside of Jerusalem, down in the south in Judea. Bethlehem is about 4 miles away from Jerusalem. Nazareth in Galilee is about 80 miles north of that. So we're in a different region called Galilee. So we're talking about a pretty significant difference. It's not like, it's not like Nazareth is next door to Bethlehem or anything like that. Okay, so that's Matthew's version. And how might we characterize Matthew's Christmas story? It's pretty dark. Joseph intends to divorce Mary, and there's the threat of potential execution there. The family has to flee from Herod. And above all, we have the massacre of the innocents. So although the Christmas story, as we know it, incorporates some elements from Matthew, especially the Magi and their star, it draws much more heavily on the Gospel of Luke. Okay, so what might account for Matthew's quite grim narrative? And here there are at least a couple possibilities. Both infancy narratives can be described as sort of mini gospels that sort of tell, sort of emphasize the concerns of their individual authors, as you see them throughout the gospels. Matthew in particular seems to be foreshadowing in his infancy narrative, conflict between Jesus and the Jewish authorities, represented here by King Herod. There's also, seems to be a fairly conscious building of the narrative off of another story from the Hebrew Bible, namely the story of the book of Exodus. And here the narrative of Matthew seems to be presenting Jesus as a new Moses, and Moses also had to escape the clutches of a murderous king as an infant. Moses and of course, Egypt plays a role in both narratives. Okay, so that's Matthew's account, and it's by far the simpler one. What's found in Luke's infancy narrative? Luke's is only 2 chapters like Matthew, but the chapters are much longer. So in chapter 1, verses 5 through 25, Zechariah is a priest in the Jerusalem temple. He and his wife Elizabeth cannot have children. The angel Gabriel appears to Zechariah in the temple and tells him that Elizabeth will conceive a son. The son, named John, would be set apart as holy and would call people back to God. But because Zechariah questioned whether or not this would really happen, the angel Gabriel rendered him unable to speak until his son was born. Then, in chapter 1, verses 26 through 38, you get the Annunciation to Mary. So Gabriel now goes to Nazareth and appears to a young girl named Mary, who is betrothed to Joseph, and Joseph is of the house of David. When Mary questions how this will happen, thankfully, Gabriel does not, you know, render her unable to speak, but she wonders how this is going to happen since she is a virgin. Gabriel tells her that she will conceive by the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son named Jesus, who will be called Son of God. And he also tells her that her relative Elizabeth has just conceived a son as well. Notice that these first two scenes are basically a doublet. The angel Gabriel announces a miraculous conception to a skeptical person and instructs them to give the child a certain name. And this is one of the things that is really distinctive about Luke as an evangelist, is that he seems to be the best storyteller of the four gospel authors. So this is a great example of Luke's literary artistry at work. Then in verses 39 through 56 of chapter 1, Mary journeys to Judea to visit her relative Elizabeth. When Mary greets Elizabeth, the child in Elizabeth's womb leaps for joy. Elizabeth is filled with the Holy Spirit and praises Mary, saying, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb." So if you've ever heard the Catholic prayer, Hail Mary, and wondered where some of that language comes from, definitely quite a bit of it comes from the Gospel of Luke. And in response, Mary sings a hymn that begins with the words, "My soul magnifies the Lord." In Latin, the first word of this hymn is the verb magnificat. It magnifies. And so because of this, the hymn is traditionally known as the Magnificat. Then, going on in the very long chapter 1, 57 through 80, John the Baptist is then born. When they circumcise him on the eighth day, Elizabeth's neighbors and relatives plan to name him Zechariah. Elizabeth insists that his name is to be John, even though none of their relatives have this name. They give a writing tablet to Zechariah, probably like a wax tablet, who confirms that his name is to be John. And then Zechariah can finally speak again, and he sings a hymn of praise called the Benedictus, which begins, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel." So thus, all of chapter 1 intertwines the stories of John the Baptist and Jesus. And this is an interesting move, because if you look at the Gospel of Mark, for instance, which seems to be the earliest of the four canonical Gospels, there's no evidence that when Jesus comes to be baptized by John, which is actually how the Gospel of Mark starts, there's no evidence that Jesus and John know each other, much less that they are actually relatives of each other. So one of the things that Luke seems to be doing is, in his infancy narrative, creating a much closer connection between John the Baptist and Jesus. Okay, then going on to Luke chapter 2, in verses 1 through 7, we get the quote-unquote real Christmas story, the story that people know the best. So the Emperor Augustus decrees a census that is going to take place, not to record demographic information, but rather for taxation purposes. He says the census is going to be empire-wide, so it's going to tax the entire world. And as a sort of edict of this census, people must return to their ancestral homes in order to pay the taxes. Luke also gives us additional historical detail. He says that the census, quote, was taken when Quirinius was governor of Syria. So he gives us something that, you know, potentially from a historical perspective, we could look up and, you know, determine whether or not this is likely to be the case. So Joseph journeys to Bethlehem with Mary, since he is of David's lineage. So Bethlehem is the hometown of King David. And so even though they live in Nazareth, again, 80 miles to the north, they go back to Bethlehem, the ancestral city for Joseph, since he is of David's lineage. While they're there, Mary gives birth to Jesus, wraps him in swaddling cloths, and lays him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. And at this last detail, you might think to yourself, what a heartless innkeeper, not sparing any room for a young couple with a new baby, so that the infant Jesus has to sleep in a manger in a stable. And, you know, we get some good songs out of it, but it just seems really sort of awful. And I remember when there was a refugee crisis going on in Syria in 2015, and, you know, there were a number of Western nations that were basically closing their doors. One person on Twitter, Oliver Willis, who's a great commentator, and, you know, follow him before Twitter goes belly up, said, you know, if only we just had a seasonally appropriate story about Middle Eastern people seeking refuge and being turned away by the heartless. And of course, it's clear what he's talking about there. All right. So, you know, not so fast, though. A number of biblical scholars have suggested that this interpretation, no room at the inn, this interpretation of a heartless innkeeper and a dirty stable is actually based on a misunderstanding of what Luke's original Greek is saying. So here's what one New Testament scholar named Stephen Carlson wrote in a recent article on Luke chapter 2, verse 7. He says, you know, basically the question is, how do you translate that phrase, there was no room at the inn? He says the clause should actually be rendered as, quote, because they did not have space in their accommodations, or because they did not have room in their place to stay. This clause means that Jesus had to be born and laid in a manger because the place where Joseph and Mary were staying did not have space for him. Luke's point is not so much any inhospitality extended to Joseph and Mary, but rather that their place was too small, their place to stay was too small to accommodate even a newborn. So what, and I won't read this entire slide, but basically what Carlson is arguing is that they're going back to Joseph's sort of ancestral home, and there is a sort of honeymoon suite, if you will, for newly married members of the family, where they can have some privacy, basically just a little, almost like a little closet or a little nook off of the sort of main room of the house. And that would be fine for, you know, two people under tight quarters. But once Mary gave birth to Jesus, it was too small in this honeymoon suite, if you call that, to actually have a baby in there. And so they move out to the main room of the house, which, you know, is essentially an ancient farmhouse. So that is potentially what Luke is talking about. His use of the term for inn is not actually the term that we normally expect for, you know, some a sort of rudimentary motel or hotel. It's not the same word, for instance, that's used in the parable of the Good Samaritan, where there is an inn that is talked about. So this is a difference. Okay, going on with the rest of Luke's infancy narrative, in chapter 2, verses 8 through 20, angels announce the birth of Jesus to shepherds in the fields outside of Bethlehem. Shepherds, the choice of shepherds is interesting here. Shepherds were often considered the lowest of the low in Israelite culture. There's even some evidence that the testimony of shepherds wasn't even admissible in courts of law. Luke seems to have a strong concern for the poor and the excluded. So this probably accounts for his featuring of the shepherds here. Then we have, going on in chapter 2, several rather obscure episodes. So Jesus is circumcised and named. There's a righteous man named Simeon who has been promised that he will not die before seeing the Messiah. And he gets to see Jesus and hold the infant Jesus. He sings a hymn, the Nunc Dimittis, now you may dismiss your servant. The aged prophet Anna proclaims Jesus's significance. And then finally, at the very end of chapter 2, 39 through 52, you get Jesus, the story of Jesus in the temple at age 12. This is, of course, not really an infancy story, but it presents Jesus as a brilliant youngster. And in doing so, Luke shows here his familiarity with a Greco-Roman trope of sort of foreshadowing the greatness of an individual, saying, you know, that for really remarkable figures, religious leaders, rulers, philosophers, people like that, that oftentimes their, you know, kind of remarkable career was already foreshadowed or hinted at from episodes during their childhood. So we can see this in lots of biographies. We can see it in a biography of, like, you know, Plato or Alexander the Great or the Emperor Augustus, so on. Okay, so what are the biggest differences between Matthew's and Luke's infancy narratives? Okay, I'll give you some of them here, and we'll also, you know, have a chance to, I'd like to hear from people about what sorts of similarities and differences you might have noticed. So one difference is length. So Matthew 1 through 2 has 48 verses. Luke 1 through 2 has a whopping 132. And if you add in Luke's genealogy, which doesn't actually show up until chapter 3, Luke's is even longer at 147 verses. Understandably so, there's also a difference in literary complexity. Matthew's stories are quite bare bones. You know, the Magi story that I've researched in particular, there's a lot of unanswered questions about who these individuals are, how they, you know, what the star is that they followed, how they understood that this star signified the birth of Jesus. So Matthew's stories are quite bare bones. Luke, on the other hand, elegantly weaves together the infancies of John the Baptist and Jesus and incorporates several lengthy hymns into it. There's also a noticeable difference in tone. Matthew's story is quite grim, whereas Luke's is very joyful. Not surprisingly, it's the Luke version that we tend to pay a lot more attention to as part of the Christmas story. And even the new "no room at the inn" passage may not actually have been intended to be as cruel as it first appears. Okay, so, you know, those are some sort of big general differences, but let's talk about this question. How much overlap is there between these stories? Are they telling the same story with different details? Or are there irreconcilable contradictions between Matthew's and Luke's accounts of Jesus's birth? And I'd like to have a little bit of a discussion here before I go on with the rest of the PowerPoint and just hear from folks about what you think based on, you know, my sort of summary and rundown of Matthew and Luke's infancy narratives. How many similarities and differences can you think of between Matthew's and Luke's accounts? And, you know, even though we're supposed to, you know, use the microphone for this, since this is just, you know, kind of a you know, going to be a little briefer, if folks want to raise their hand, and then for the folks on who are joining us via Zoom, I'll repeat the points that are made. But yeah, what do you see in terms of similarities or differences between Matthew and Luke's accounts? Yes. Okay, so the places are the same. Both Matthew and Luke agree that Jesus is born in Bethlehem. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, depending on which version you look at, the sort of movements of Jesus are unusual. There is, or don't rather seem to be, you know, exactly the same. So you get the flight to Egypt in the Gospel of Matthew. You have the journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem for the census in Luke. Let's see, we've got also some Zoom versions here. Let's see. Oh, yeah, okay. Good deal. Thanks, Chad. Other similarities or differences that folks notice? Yeah. Okay, It absolutely is. Certainly, so Luke, so this this comment was about sort of the macho characteristics of Matthew versus the character sort of more feminine or tender characteristics of Luke's gospel. And that's absolutely the case. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus never, excuse me, Mary never actually talks at all. So we have no clue what's going on with her and her sort of thought process through all of these extraordinary events compared with Luke's gospel, where she actually does a fair amount of talking. Let's see here. Can he? Yeah, no, I know. So what I'm doing, Roger, is not having people go up to the microphone just for right now, but rather having people, you know, just kind of call out their answers, and then I'm summarizing what they're doing. So when we actually do the Q&A, So when we do the Q&A, we'll actually do the microphone. So basically, I'm just summarizing what people have to say. Yes. Okay, say more. What you think there are two different target audiences? What do you think? Yeah. So certainly, I mean, as I said before, you've got, so Matthew is, so this is about the sort of difference in target audiences. So Matthew is definitely coming across as you know, more Jewish in his orientation. Certainly, he's the one who has all these scriptural fulfillments. He has Jesus sort of echoing the Moses traditions. Luke is definitely more Gentile. So the you know, the event that sort of ushers in or that is the occasion for the birth of Jesus in Luke's gospel is a census undertaken by the Roman emperor. So not only does Luke sort of emphasize sort of the role of non-Jews, but he also emphasizes sort of how Jesus, you know, Jesus comes comes into the world sort of at, you know, on the backdrop of world history, as it were. So yeah, great. Other similarities or differences? I think we've, yeah, certainly. So John the Baptist, another difference, is that Luke is the one who pays attention to the John the Baptist, birth story. And there's nothing about John the Baptist in Matthew's account. Okay, so now let's get into, so now that we've seen some of these, differences, So some problems of historicity with the infancy narratives. So Matthew and Luke's stories are generally regarded by scholars as having several contradictory elements to them. And an especially significant one is their respective explanations for how Jesus is born in Bethlehem, but grows up in Nazareth. Now, you might, you know, we had noticed that both Matthew and Luke agree that that Jesus is born in Bethlehem. But if we sort of dig a little deeper than that and sort of try and figure out, you know, their explanations for why Jesus is born in Bethlehem, we actually run into some surprising differences. So according to Luke, and Luke is the easier one to see this way, Jesus's parents live in Nazareth. They only go to Bethlehem for the census and only because of the, you know, rule about the census that everybody is supposed to return to their ancestral hometowns. So that's why they go to Bethlehem for the census, but they don't stay in Bethlehem. After Jesus is born and after they presumably pay their taxes, then they return to Nazareth. For Matthew, Jesus seems to be born in Bethlehem. Now this is, Jesus is born in Bethlehem because that's where his parents live. this is not quite as clear and as easy to see, because when we're introduced in Matthew chapter 1 to Mary and Joseph, where with the narrative of Joseph discovering Mary is pregnant and planning to divorce her quietly, we're not giving any sort of geographical setting for this. But once we get into the Magi story, what we notice is that they are that the Magi come to a house in Bethlehem. And after the Holy Family flees to Egypt, Joseph seems to be intending to go back to Bethlehem. So all of that seems to be pointing to the fact that for Matthew, Jesus is born in Bethlehem because that's where his parents live. As I said, they only leave Bethlehem because Herod is trying to kill the child. And only after the flight to Bethlehem do they relocate to Nazareth. And at first, you know, Joseph is wanting to go back to Nazareth, but he's sort of hesitant that way. Okay, so they don't actually agree about why and under what circumstances Jesus was born in Bethlehem. For Luke, it's because of the census that makes them travel. For Matthew, it seems as if they're born in Bethlehem because that's Jesus is born in Bethlehem because that's where his parents live. So if Matthew and Luke don't agree about why Jesus was born in Bethlehem, then perhaps he wasn't actually born there. And after all, think about what he is known as in the Gospels. He becomes known as Jesus of Nazareth. And it's not impossible that, you know, somebody might become sort of more famous for the place where they grew up rather than necessarily the place that they were born. But it's also worth keeping in mind that people in the ancient world generally didn't move around very much, and certainly not people who sort of live in traditional villages. So, you know, if you meet someone called Jesus of Nazareth, and you know something about Nazareth being this sort of fairly small, unimportant village, it stands to reason that that's actually where the person is from. So why might Matthew and Luke be both trying to get Jesus born in Bethlehem? Well, maybe they're trying to place Jesus's birth there because that's King David's hometown, and that's where the Messiah is supposed to come from. And if we flip over to one of the other Gospels for a moment, we run into a sort of an interesting little passage and an interesting question from the Gospel of John. And the question is, does the Gospel of John believe that Jesus was born in Bethlehem? Or does he even know anything about this tradition? And based on this, I don't think he does. So the passage I'm talking about here is John chapter 7, verses 41 and 42. And it's a debate among people who are listening to Jesus about whether or not he might be the Messiah. And here's what they say. Others said, this is the Messiah. But some asked, surely the Messiah doesn't come from Galilee, does he? You know, that's where Nazareth is. Has not the scripture said that the Messiah is descended from David and comes from Bethlehem, the village where David lived? I read that as maybe that John has never actually heard about this Bethlehem tradition. For all he knows, Jesus comes from Nazareth. So apart from the contradictory explanations for, let's see, smart device. Does it go away? Okay, good. All right. So apart from this contradictory explanation, these explanations for why Jesus is born in Bethlehem, there are also some other historical problems. And one of them is that the details of Luke's census are particularly problematic in terms of historical plausibility. Why? Well, one reason is that the Romans never forced people to travel to distant places for the privilege of paying their taxes. The Romans were really horrible and nasty, but they were at least kind enough to come to you to take your money. Second reason is that the Romans, so far as we know, never conducted empire-wide censuses, as Luke asserts that this event was. Rather, provinces would conduct censuses sort of on their own as they saw fit. And then remember that Luke tells us that this took place while Quirinius was a governor. And we say, oh, that's interesting. It'd be interesting to see if we can verify that. Well, as a third reason, yes, there was a census while Quirinius was a governor, but the dates don't add up. If we assume that Jesus was born shortly before the death of King Herod, because, you know, Matthew has King Herod as a major villain, and Luke actually tells us at the very beginning of his infancy narrative that this was that the birth of Jesus and the birth of John the Baptist took place while Herod was still alive. Herod dies in 4 BCE, and Quirinius, the census under Quirinius took place in the year 6 AD or 6 CE. And, you know, if you do the math between those two, basically Jesus would have been around 10 years old at the time that the census under Quirinius happened. So the dates for this census don't add up. And there are some, you know, really sort of questionable assertions made by Luke about, you know, how this census is supposed to have gone down. So also, some significant issues with the virgin birth. And here I'm not simply talking about sort of, you know, the miraculous claims about it. Here I'm not even going to sort of engage in, like, you know, whether it's physically possible for something like this to happen. Rather, I'm going to talk about some other problems. And that is that in the New Testament, this belief only appears in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Neither Mark nor John seem to have any evidence of this tradition of a virgin birth, nor does the Apostle Paul. And in terms of chronology here, I mean, certainly you know that the Apostle Paul and his letters are a major part of the New Testament corpus. What you might not know is that Paul's letters are from a couple decades before the Gospels. So Paul's writings are the earliest Christian writings we have, period. They're mostly from the decade of the 50s. Paul doesn't seem to know anything about this virgin birth tradition. In fact, some of the other passages in these texts seem to presuppose that someone else is Jesus's father. So this is from Paul's letter to the Romans, and this is from Romans chapter 1, verses 3 through 4. So it's right at the very beginning of his letter, sort of his prologue to the letter. And here's what the passage says. Paul says, "The gospel concerning his son, who was descended from David according to the flesh and was declared to be son of God with power according to the spirit of holiness by resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ, our Lord." So a couple interesting things there, and it's a complicated passage, but it seems to be saying that Jesus is a biological descendant of King David, according to the flesh. So that would mean, because descent goes through the father in ancient Judaism, that Jesus would have to have a human father. Presumably, this passage is, you know, has Joseph in mind in this. Also notice how Jesus becomes Son of God. He's declared the Son of God by the Holy Spirit at the time of his resurrection. So this makes it sound as if, you know, the sort of designation of Jesus as the Son of God is not something that happens from the very beginning of his life, but actually happens at the very, you know, end of his life, or even after his death, at the moment of the resurrection. And this Romans passage, you know, not only is it in one of Paul's letters, which makes it sort of the earliest layer of the New Testament writings, but this Romans passage itself may have been a very early creedal statement used by the church in Rome, which was already a well-established community by the time Paul wrote them in the late 50s. So it may be that Paul himself didn't actually write this little phrase. This was part of a pre-Pauline creed that was used by the Roman church, which would make it really, really early. Another passage that doesn't seem to know anything about the virgin birth and seems to envision Joseph as the father. Here we go in John chapter 1, verses 45 through 46. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Again, you know, it's not a noteworthy place. Philip said to him, "Come and see." Okay, so what's going on here with these passages that seem to presuppose that Jesus has a human father and that his father is Joseph, who is, you know, kind of denied as the father in the infancy narratives? My theory is that Joseph's parentage of Jesus started to be denied, started to be, you know, negated when Christians began to believe that Jesus needed to have God as his biological father in order to truly be the Son of God. And before this point, you know, so we don't know exactly when this happened, but maybe, you know, in the mid to late first century. Before this, it seems as if Christians were content to understand Jesus as God's son, but rather God's son by adoption. And that the adoption was sort of the God designating Jesus as his son, sometimes was understood to have occurred at the resurrection, sometimes understood to have occurred at Jesus's baptism. The Gospel of Mark, which is the earliest Christian gospel, begins, and it says it's the beginning of the good news, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus. So it says it's starting at the beginning, but where does it start? It starts with the baptism. And at the baptism, you have this voice from heaven saying, "You are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased." And a lot of scholars read that as Mark actually thinks that that's when Jesus became the Son of God, at the moment of his baptism. Obviously, that's a very different understanding of Jesus's relationship to God than has, you know, sort of developed in the Christian church. Okay, so I've laid out some real significant historical difficulties with these narratives about Jesus's birth. And before we do questions, I should point out that the problems of historicity that affect these birth stories, and I think they definitely do affect them, these do not necessarily affect the historicity of other parts of the Jesus tradition. That is, much of the information about Jesus found in the rest of the Gospels is historically accurate in its general claims. So not all of, put differently, not all of the material about Jesus found in the Gospels is as historically dubious as the material about Jesus in the infancy narratives. Specifically, I would view as largely historical the following details about Jesus: that he taught about the kingdom of God, that he had a reputation as an exorcist and a miracle worker, that he made powerful enemies with his subversive teachings and behavior, that he was crucified by the Romans for the crime of political insurrection, and that a number of his closest followers believed that they saw him alive in the days and weeks following his execution. So this might help to relativize the arguments that I've been making here about the doubtful historicity of the Christmas story. But let's discuss. So thank you very much. Okay, and for the Q&A period, and I will basically, for those of you who are here in person, if you'd be so kind as to either come up to the microphone, or if you need the microphone brought to you, Chad, do we know, does this microphone work and travel around? Yeah, but if it's easier for somebody in terms of mobility to have the microphone brought to them, feel free to raise your hand. And if you are joining us on Zoom, feel free to put your question in the chat, and I will answer it as soon as I can. And I'll try and do a fair balance between those people who are here in person and those people who are joining us on Zoom. So, questions? really and truly hope I haven't ruined Christmas for everybody.
Can you give us a sort of a timeline of when the various books of the gospel were written and how old mm-hmm. writers were likely to have been?
Yeah. So, folks on Zoom, were you able to hear that question? So the question, just in case that didn't come through, was about sort of the chronology of the writings that I'm talking about here, and the Gospels in particular. So, as I was saying, the earliest Christian writings that we have, at least in terms of the way the traditional chronology gets reconstructed, is the letters of the Apostle Paul are the earliest writings. Most of those come from the decade of the 50s. The earliest writing of Paul's is, scholars believe, is actually 1 Thessalonians. And that's not his most famous letter, but in terms of the chronology of which churches, which areas he visits in Acts of the Apostles, Thessaloniki seems to be the earliest on that list. So that's why 1 Thessalonians is regarded by many scholars as the earliest Christian writing we possess. Then the Gospels themselves seem to come into the picture a couple decades after that, and seem to be to some degree influenced by the fact that, you know, some of these early eyewitnesses and followers of Jesus are starting to die off in the 60s. And then there's a disastrous Jewish revolt against the Romans that takes place and culminates with the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in the year 70. And at least three of our Gospels, Matthew, Luke, and John, seem to contain unmistakable allusions to this destruction of the temple. Mark may or may not. So scholars think that Mark was probably written right around the year 70, maybe a little earlier, maybe a little bit later. Matthew and Luke, maybe sometime in the 80s or 90s. John, maybe a little bit later than that in the 90s. I would not be opposed to saying that John is actually a little earlier, maybe that John is writing about the same time as Matthew and Luke. But basically, when we're talking about the Gospels, the four Gospels as a whole, we're talking about, you know, the last three decades of the first century. So that's the time frame. In terms of, you know, what we know about, you know, how old the evangelists were or what their identities were, that's all kind of up for grabs, because the Gospels themselves, in the actual text of the Gospels, they don't tell us much of anything about the individuals who are responsible for this. The only Gospel that really tells us a fair amount about the circumstances of its author is the Gospel of Luke. It doesn't tell us who the author was, but if you look at the prologue to Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, one of the things that he makes really clear is that he's not an eyewitness to these events that he's talking about. In fact, he describes himself as being, you know, maybe removed by a generation or two from the eyewitnesses. Even though there's kind of a, you know, traditional understanding that the Gospels are written by eyewitnesses to Jesus's ministry, there are a number of reasons to be skeptical of that as well. Can you please take down the stop screen sharing? Okay. Hang on here. Okay. Does that work? Now, can everybody see? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So in the Bible, there's a lot of stories about helpers. And so my question is, in your research, did you find anything about midwives or any helpers during the births? Because there had to be somebody else in the room.
Yeah, great question. Okay, so were there helpers or were there midwives? So not in Luke's account. And, you know, so Luke is the only one of the two that actually describes the moment of Jesus's birth. Matthew just sort of passes over it because, you know, Mary has conceived in Matthew chapter one. But then by the time the Magi show up at the beginning of chapter two, Jesus has already been born. So, you know, the birth itself is never actually narrated in Matthew's version. It is narrated in Luke's version, but yeah, there's no midwife present. And some scholars have detected a, sort of a hint that it is a miraculous conception, because not only is Mary giving birth by herself, but then she's actually, you know, swaddling the baby by herself. So, you know, there are some maybe faint hints that this is supposed to be a miraculous conception without pain. And this is a tradition that does develop in early Christianity about sort of that this is a miraculous birth. And so there is a famous quotation that's attributed to a couple different early Christians that says, Jesus went through Mary like water through a pipe. Basically that, you know, this was, you know, not at all your sort of typical birth. But, you know, in terms of, so there's no midwife said to be present in Luke's gospel, but if we look at the earliest non-canonical or apocryphal infancy narrative that sort of elaborates on the stories of Matthew and Luke, it's a text from the early second century called the Protoevangelium of James, or the infancy gospel of James. And in that, there is a midwife, but the midwife is not actually needed. You know, the midwife is, Joseph goes to fetch the midwife, but by the time, you know, he and the midwife go back, Jesus has already been born. So again, it's described as sort of thoroughly miraculous and, you know, absolutely sort of no need of a midwife, or none of the, you know, kind of, you know, agony of childbirth.
I've always understood that when the Gospels are written, the resurrection, the crucifixion, the resurrection were the first parts of the Gospels to be written. Mm-hmm. And then it went back from there. Mm-hmm. So that the birth was part of the last to be. And it seems like that might explain some of the legendary.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So the question was about, or the comment was about the fact that different parts of the Gospels and different parts of the Jesus tradition seem to be written at different times. And the earliest layer, or at least one of the earliest layers of the Gospels, is often thought to be the stories of the end of Jesus's life. Basically the story of his death. The question of the story of the crucifixion may well be the earliest part of the Gospels. The resurrection stories, it's hard to say how early those are. You know, they might be in some cases a little bit on the later side, but certainly the tradition and the sort of assertion that Jesus did appear to some of his earliest followers, that's a very, very ancient claim. We see that in Paul's letters. So that's definitely there. On the other hand, as you say about the infancy narratives, these seem to be sort of a late accretion on the gospel tradition. They seem to not have been kind of, you know, the earliest part of the story that Christians were interested in telling. And a number of scholars would say that the reason that the infancy narratives don't show up at first is because, you know, for a while, Christians are content understanding Jesus as the Son of God because he has, you know, either, you know, and here the answers are different, either that, you know, he was adopted by God, or, you know, if you follow John's gospel, he's existed from the beginning of time. You know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And but, you know, with John's prologue there, there's not really a lot of interest in the circumstances of Jesus's birth, because that would have been sort of anticlimactic. What John cares about is telling you that Jesus has existed from the very beginning of time. So a lot of scholars would say that You know, it was only after, you know, Christians had really started to reflect on what it meant for Jesus to be the Son of God and to think, oh, you know, that there was some more curiosity about what the circumstances were of his birth, that maybe that's when the stories started getting created. In fact, you can actually, you know, if you read, say, Luke's gospel, for instance, and you look at, you know, so Mary seems to know everything about the significance of Jesus based on, you know, the angel Gabriel appearing to her. But other times in the gospel, she seems kind of clueless about why Jesus is so special. And it's like, weren't you paying attention when the angel Gabriel? So it sort of reads almost as if it's, as if the infancy narrative was perhaps a little bit tacked on and wasn't, you know, kind of completely integrated into the rest of the gospel story. So yeah, great question. From Jane on Zoom, you've given me so much to ponder and address many questions I myself have had. Sort of takes the focus off how Christianity began and its validity to a template for living as God intends we should live. Too easy for a conclusion to draw. I think one thing to just keep in mind is certainly that the birth of Jesus was not as central of an event for the first Christians as it is for us. You know, certainly in terms of kind of popular culture, American popular culture, Christmas is a bigger deal, is much more culturally significant than Easter. It's not that Easter isn't, you know, important or anything like that, but certainly, you know, if you certainly in terms of, you think about sort of the impact on, you know, businesses and the economy and, you know, kind of travel plans and all of that stuff, you know, Christmas looms pretty large. But for the earliest Christians, they were much more interested in and much more sort of reflective on the end of Jesus's life and how, you know, not only how Jesus died and the resurrection appearances, but also we have to keep in mind that this was a really traumatic, you know, really sort of earth-shattering event for the early Christians. They had believed, the people who had followed Jesus around, that Jesus was the Messiah. And you have to keep in mind that the Messiah was supposed to be sort of a political or military leader. He was supposed to rescue the Jewish people from oppression by the Romans. And because of that, it was not in the Messiah's job description to die on a Roman cross. Pretty much, you know, for most of the Jews who were following Jesus's career, once Jesus died on the cross, they said, well, that he can't be the Messiah. Because that's not, you know, the Messiah is supposed to defeat the Romans, not be crucified by them. And, you know, what early Christians tried to do, and they did this through searching the Jewish scriptures, was to say, is there a way that this could actually, that this tragic event could have been part of God's plan? And that, you know, despite all evidence to the contrary, maybe Jesus was God's anointed. Maybe he was God's son. And part of the reason I think, I would argue, that they sort of held on to this so much in the face of, you know, kind of ridicule from their kinsfolk was because of the reports of the resurrection appearances, that there were a number of close followers of Jesus who really truly believed that they had seen him alive and were trying to make sense of this. And one of the earliest ways that they seem to have made sense of it is that God has vindicated his mission somehow. Yeah.
Just a couple of comments, maybe as a woman's perspective.
Yeah.
Like that these dudes are the ones that said that the birth was so easy.
That's yeah. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the other thing I was thinking about is with Mary, you know, like knowing and not knowing kind of to me reminds me of our faith, you know, mm-hmm. We go through.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. Great, great comments. Yeah. No, I mean, and this is worth keeping in mind is, you know, that there is, you know, It's pretty likely. We don't know exactly who wrote the four Gospels, but the chances are that all of them are, you know, written by men. And that certainly, in the case of, the circumstances of Jesus's birth and that narrative sort of skews things. So we see, for instance, not a lot of reflection on the birth. One of my favorite passages along these lines is that in the Gospel of Mark, there is when Jesus is anointed shortly before his death, he says, you know, what this woman did, you know, this story will be told all over the world in memory of her, but never actually gives her name. It's like Mark forgot. Oh, by the way, I should have mentioned her name. Like, that would have been helpful. No. So anything else? Any other questions? I mean, what I would say also, and this is just important, I think, to keep in mind, is that, yes, these are, these are great stories. These are really compelling stories. I don't think that the early Christians, Matthew and Luke, the evangelists who were coming, you know, who were sort of largely inventing these stories about Jesus's birth, I don't think they were doing it with an intent to sort of deceive or to make people think, to believe, you know, kind of incorrect or inaccurate information. I think that, you know, one of the things we have to keep in mind is that for ancient historians, there was much more of a sort of fast and loose relationship with the facts than I think a lot of us would be comfortable with. And really, you know, a lot of sort of, particularly in cases where the information wasn't very good, part of the responsibility of an ancient historian or a storyteller was to tell a good story, or to imagine, well, this is how it must have been, or, you know, it must have been something like this. And so, you know, I don't think that they're sort of concocting these stories with the sort of, with a deceptive intent to them. They just had sort of a different understanding of, you know, what do you do when you don't have any information? Because that's probably the case, is that nobody knew much of anything about Jesus's birth. It's interesting that in the first gospel, the Gospel of Mark, there we actually even see some indications that Jesus is alienated from his family. Look at Mark chapter 3. His family wants to take him away because because people are saying that he's gone out of his mind, that he's crazy. He seems to have an acrimonious relationship with his family. And so my guess is that even Jesus's closest followers didn't actually know that much about his early background. So there we are. Thank you very much.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.